Hello, welcome once again to the Turkey Book Talk podcast. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page or my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you have some spare change, or if you're very wealthy, you can also donate to support the podcast via my new Patreon page. I produce this podcast for free, but through that Patreon account, you can help support me by pledging a small monetary donation on a per episode basis. Your support will help cover the costs and the time it takes to produce each podcast, and it will help me improve the show. Find details on how to donate via all the Turkey Book Talk pages or via my website, and many thanks to current supporters, Sarah Alexandra Marshall and Andrew Cruikshank. Now on with the show. For this podcast, I'm very pleased to welcome Cihan Tuğal, who's the author of a new book, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism, which is published by Verso. The idea of Turkey as a model country goes back to the start of the Cold War, and it's meant many different things at different times. But under the AKP government, it came to mean a marriage of free market capitalism and moderate Islamic democracy. It's now widely accepted that this model has collapsed in recent years as the Turkish government has become increasingly authoritarian, and Tuğal's book tackles the question from the left. It argues that the fall of the Turkish model was inevitable because of the fragility of the combination of free market economic policies with conservative religion. I open by asking Cihan Tuğal why that collapse has happened now.
So we should first understand what the model was. So what is most publicly emphasized is the combination. That's perhaps what is foremost on the minds of people when they say Turkish model. But then when you start to read in between the lines, you start to see that neoliberalism, so one extreme form of free market capitalism, was a part of that combination too. So not just Islam and democracy, but also neoliberal capitalism was really what constituted the model. But we should even further qualify it, because we're really talking about one kind of Islam and one kind of democracy. So we're not talking about the more progressive kinds of Islam, and we are not talking about the most reactionary forms of Islam either. So this is sort of like a middle of the road, conservative, moderate Islam. But what has been almost willfully neglected was that conservative Islam, even if a moderate form of that conservatism. So the Justice and Development Party, the AK Party, had been turning Turkey into a more and more conservative country, and this was seen as the unescapable price of this combination of Islam and democracy. And this helps me build up to the second qualification, the democracy. What kind of democracy are we talking about? Of course, liberal formal democracy, but a restricted form of that liberal democracy. So the people who espouse this model never really expected Turkey to become as liberally democratic as the Anglophone model. So even though that was, you know, that remained throughout the successful first two terms of the AK Party, the Anglophone model remained the model for the party and for Turkey. It's never got close, and never intended to get very close to liberal democracy of the Anglo type. But even this quite, in my eyes, very depressing combination of some authoritarian form of liberal democracy and free market capitalism and conservative religion, even this turned out to be quite short-lived in the case of Turkey. I think there is something wrong in the model itself. Conservative religion plus liberal authoritarian democracy plus free capitalism, that does not seem to be a very sustainable combination. For reasons I can go point to later if you want to. But then there were conditions quite specific to Turkey too, like the exclusion of Kurds and the heterodox Muslim population, Alevis, from this model from the very beginning. And the Alevis remained excluded by definition, whereas there were always fluctuations regarding the exclusion inclusion of Kurds. It seemed that if Kurds dropped their goals of progressive forms of autonomy / independence, and they more carefully weeded out any remnants of Marxism, if there remained any, in their political program, if they became more conservative, perhaps they could be included in this model too. But that process did not develop as fast as the regime desired. So both the Kurdish and Alevi specificities of in Turkey more exclusive than it is in its home countries of Britain and the US.
You say the AKP was always authoritarian, but it kind of dressed this authoritarianism up in democratic and Islamic garb. And that narrative was very seductive in the West for a while, which was looking for this moderate, economically open Muslim partner in the Middle East. Why do you think that the narrative was so seductive?
First of all, the Western world was had been moving in that direction for a while, rediscovering the virtues of the free market, rediscovering the virtues of conservative religion, and it seemed to work in the 1980s and 1990s. Of course, something like this had been already in process in Latin America, but without the dimensions of conservative religion and restricted liberal democracy. So neoliberalism had started in Latin America, but it was very dictatorial and very top-down. And what happened with Reagan, Thatcher, and in Turkey with Özal, and with more force with the Justice and Development Party, was the popularization of neoliberalism. And that happened mostly through conservative religion. But there was one difference that largely went neglected in all of this process. While Özalism in Turkey, the motherland party government, was much more similar to Thatcher and Reagan and their combination of neoliberalism, some sort of democracy, and conservative religion, the AK Party combination was politically different because it involved a lot of people that came from a quite distinctly different background. And this was the Islamist movement with its strong populism, anti-establishment message, and some sort of anti-capitalism, even though, you know, it's not like, you know, socialism or communism, obviously, but some sort of anti-capitalist rhetoric. And the explosiveness of this combination was not perceived. So this was wrongly perceived in the West to be a repetition of the Thatcherite and Reaganite success. So just a Middle Eastern version of Reaganite conservatism or neoconservatism.
So the Refah Party roots were somehow stronger and exerted this force over the AKP, which ended up superseding the early neoliberal first term of the AKP.
Yeah, the first two terms, yes. So this started to happen in the third term, but the roots were of the transformation were in the first two terms. And what is even more interesting, and I know that this is getting very complicated, but it's not even just the Refah Party. What the AK Party did is that it integrated a lot of people from the Islamist movement who were more radical than the Refah Party. So these were the intellectual and political and activist circles of the 1980s and 1990s who were so anti-establishment that they rejected political parties, so never became a part of the Refah Party. They were more sympathetic, or at least some of them were more sympathetic to the Iranian revolution. So in that sense, the AK Party, while bringing Turkey closer to the center of the global system, closer to the West, also interestingly short-circuited Islamist populism of the Refah Party and built itself on the more radical populism of these anti-Refah and pro-Iranian elements.
And those elements remained in the background for a while, but as you describe it in the book, you specifically refer to the Arab Spring as exposing the limits of this earlier model. And that's quite ironic in a way, because there was, of course, a lot of talk during the Arab uprisings about Turkey's lessons for the region. But in your account, how did this regional meltdown expose the failure of the Turkish model?
So what happened first was an honest push to export the model as it existed in the AK Party's first two terms into Egypt, Libya, Syria, and other regions of revolt. And Egypt is the most interesting case because links already existed between the Egyptian government. There were many free trade zones in Egypt where Turkish businesses operated, and they were already a part of the neoliberal development program of Hosni Mubarak's regime. And what the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood basically promised the world was the continuation of that neoliberalism, Hosni Mubarak's neoliberalism, in a more democratic and Islamic fashion. So this is exactly what the AK Party had done in Turkey. So it had taken the neoliberal secularism of the 1980s and 1990s and made it much, much more religious. So now the world hoped the same thing could happen in Egypt. And there were more and more contacts between Turkey and Egypt, some diplomatic, some economic, and some directly political. So on the economic front, Erdogan and many businessmen, hundreds of businessmen, traveled to Egypt, organized conferences, meetings, so new business opportunities were opened in a highly boisterous fashion. You know, I mean, this wasn't just business in the background, but this became a part of the show in Egypt, a show of modernization. Look, we are really doing this now. Sort of message. But in the background, something else was happening too. Egyptian politicians, especially from the Muslim Brotherhood, were coming to Turkey and taking seminars behind closed doors. So nobody knows what was really discussed, but it was broadly speculated that the AK Party was teaching them how to marginalize military power and get hold of the reins and assume total power, because the transition was not complete in Egypt back then. The military was still in control, and the situation resembled somewhat the first 1.5 terms of the AK Party. So the AK Party in Turkey decisively changed the balances perhaps between 2007 and 2010. Okay, so in the middle of its second term. And it was speculated that it was teaching behind closed doors the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood how to do the same thing. But apparently it didn't work. They couldn't do it. They rushed. They wanted to assume total control too quickly. And that was followed by a coup. So that's what happened in Egypt. And Libya and Syria are more familiar stories, so I won't go into depth there. Turkey's role is well known, maybe less well known in Libya. Turkey tried a more aggressive push in Libya, but the French president and the French state overall did not permit that to happen. But regardless of, you know, Turkey's desires, that was a total failure on the part of the West too. So the desired transformation could not happen in Libya. And the most tragic case, of course, is Syria. Once the Turkish regime could not get its way, it militarized this struggle further and further, and that had repercussions in the more the struggle in Syria was militarized, the more sectarian it became. It drew in Iran and Saudi Arabia and the Lebanese Hezbollah before it fully drew in Russia. But the whole Arab Spring started to be perceived through sectarian lenses, and the national repercussion, internal repercussion of that in Turkey was that the regime and the parts of the population that support the regime started to perceive themselves as much, much more Sunni and anti-Shia. And even though the links between the Shia or the Alawites in Syria and the Alevis in Turkey are very loose, I mean, both religiously and politically, they have close to zero links, actually. But since the whole region became extremely sectarianized, the rifts in Turkey started to be perceived more along these lines. So I'm not saying that the Alevi-Sunni distinction didn't matter. I just said in the beginning that this was an important aspect of the new regime in Turkey. It was more Sunni than the preceding regimes, but it went to extremes after the Arab Spring. And I can give many examples of this, but just one blatant example is that the Erdogan, who was the prime minister back then, started to underline that one of his competitors in the opposition, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is still at the head of the Republican People's Party, is an Alevi. And whenever he mentioned this in public meetings, in election rallies, there were strong boos from the crowd. This kind of sectarian tension was not that much in the open in election rallies in Turkey. So after the Arab Spring, this became more and more the case. And after all of these quote-unquote revolutions failed, the regime could no longer dream of exporting its model. So the first phase was of Turkish soft power implementing Islamic liberalism or Islamic liberal democracy in these countries, Libya, Egypt, Syria at the forefront, but secondarily other cases too. And after 2013, the regime became more focused on hard power, and it emphasized militarization further, and the consequences are still disastrous for Turkey, because Turkey now in its desperation continued to arm the jihadis, and we can see the results today in Turkey. The jihadis are coming back and blowing themselves up, and at first perhaps this didn't disturb the government that much, because they specifically targeted Marxist activists first in Suruç and then Kurdish activists in Ankara. And it seems that this is going to spread further and further. And who knows what's going to happen over the summer? Perhaps it will migrate from Ankara to Istanbul. The bombings will migrate to the more touristic south. I mean, anything is possible after this point, because there are so many jihadis empowered by this situation that even a more successful intelligence system could not control them. But Turkey's intelligence infrastructure is not that strong to begin with.
And part of the whole breakdown that has happened has been this breakdown with the Gulen movement and the AKP and Erdogan. And it seems that this breakdown has basically affected the AKP's ability to propagandize for the Turkish model in the West, because there's been a notable lack of professionalism both in the Turkish state, but also in the way that the Turkish government presents its case to the West. You know, back in the day, I mean, the Gulenists have been many things, but they certainly do know how to put together a slick argument. They used to use that ability in the service of the government previously, before they had this breakdown. And now the government seems to feel this lack. Do you think that there has been this contribution of the fallout with the Gulenists affecting the persuasiveness of the idea of the Turkish model in the West?
Yes, that question is right on target. So the Gulen community was really a very important, very crucial part of the old new regime in Turkey. So the AK Party regime from 2002 to around 2013, and important. It was important in many regards. So there are these links with the West. They know marketing much more better than the AK Party's usual constituency and activists. So they have links, they have marketing skills, but also overall, their religion and ideology has been much more along the lines of Reaganism, Thatcherism for decades. So it came much more natural to them, this combination of, you know, some restricted form of liberal democracy, some moderate conservative religion, and free market capitalism. They had already combined these elements in the 1970s. If you listen to Gulen's sermons in the late 1970s, he sounds already like an American conservative preacher. And his organizations in the U.S. also have links to Washington, D.C. So from the middle ranks of the American academia, the political elite, the economic elite, they're very well linked. And they know how to market themselves, and they know how to market Turkey. So in all of those regards, Gulen was a very important part of the AK Party regime and its international links. But it wasn't just that. Religiously and ideologically, too, Gulen was already naturally much more along the lines of Reaganism and Thatcherism. He already had combined conservative capitalism and authoritarian liberal democracy in his sermons, starting with the late 1970s. So whereas the AK Party and its other non-Gulen cadres had come to this line only in the early 2000s, Gulen had been preaching this version of Islam for decades. So he did it much more naturally and convincingly, and he had the cadres to do it. So cadres is more actually other point, and it's not just reducible to ideology and religion. Well, what the Gulen community also contributed to the regime was a high level, a big number of high level, high quality cadres. So what we need to understand about the AK Party regime in its first two successful terms was that it pushed out a lot of secularist people from within the government bureaucracy. It cleansed the police, the courts, and the educational system. But who filled the gaps? It was mostly the Gulenists, because the AK Party had a lot of successful politicians. The non-Gulen component of the AK Party had a lot of successful politicians, but not a lot of successful civic bureaucrats and judges, etc. So this is also what the Gulen people contributed. So this is going to be disastrous for the AK Party in the longer term. You know, what are they going to do with the academia now that they're cleansing the academia of these secularists and not secularists, actually leftists, right? They're cleansing the left. I mean, they're own people are not of that caliber. So the civic bureaucracy, the academia, the educational system overall is going to suffer very much in the long term because of the fallout between Gulen and Erdogan.
And I just also want to just dig a little more and maybe push back slightly on the economic question that you describe in the book. I mean, you describe how this process of how politically and economically disadvantaged parts of the population were included into established institutions and by extension were kind of subsumed into the market system progressively under the AKP. I mean, and I wondered why that is necessarily a bad thing, because in healthcare, for example, there was this vast expansion of health insurance coverage to poorer people. and, you know, the number of mothers dying in childbirth fell, infant mortality fell, and the proportion of families pushed into poverty by medical expenses also fell dramatically. I mean, according to various surveys, public satisfaction with healthcare services in Turkey has risen in recent years. It's obviously not a utopia, but it may be an improvement. So for you, how has Turkey's economic model collapsed? Because although it may not be doing as well as it once was, or maybe the advances were exaggerated, there were also genuine, tangible advances that were made under the AKP.
Yeah, I wouldn't talk of a collapse yet. There is certainly a crisis, but not a collapse. So it is true, it's absolutely right, that some parts of the population started to get advantages that they wouldn't have dreamed of in regular neoliberalism, which had been applied in Turkey in the 1980s and 1990s. But we have to look at this as a global transformation of neoliberalism. This isn't just specific to Turkey. So now this is the Obama version, Clinton version, of or Blair version of neoliberalism in Turkey. It's a more socialized neoliberalism, but it is still neoliberalism, and I'll try to explain that. So what was known as the Washington Consensus had characterized neoliberalism in the 1980s and 1990s. And this was a very straightforward, you know, dismantle welfare, de-unionize everybody, make everybody pray to the markets kind of neoliberalism. But it was discovered by the end of the 1990s that this didn't work. Not in the West, it didn't work in the West, it didn't work anywhere else. So social programs had to be added to neoliberalism, and this came to be known as the post-Washington consensus. So neoliberal economists and the IMF and the World Bank still coalesced around this. The same idea of, you know, privatization, the decreasing role of governments, et cetera, these were still recognized as the pillars of the new economy, but we had to add some social programs to this in the new neoliberal consensus of the 2000s. So that we saw in Turkey in healthcare, but not much elsewhere. For example, not much in education, even though the government trumpeted its ability to give everybody a laptop and similar policies, or intended policies at least. I mean, this wasn't really applied everywhere, but it was at least intended. But overall, the education budget is very small, and yeah, public education kept deteriorating. So even on the social policies front, the new neoliberalism was not that strong. And more broadly speaking, we still have to see this social neoliberalism as a persistent class war. In what sense? Well, the idea became, you know, and this is echoed in other economic policies as well, not just social policies. The idea became bottom billion capitalism. So we are going to help the people who live in extreme poverty. But this didn't mean we are going to try to make the playing field level for everybody. So inequality actually persisted under the AK Party. So if you look at other indicators, such as the distribution of income didn't improve, the distribution of wealth got worse and worse. So the top 1% phenomenon that everybody has been talking about in the US, in Britain, that became worse and worse under the AK Party. And other stuff like unemployment, this new neoliberalism could not resolve unemployment. Unemployment kept rising under the AK Party. And actually, the most devastating indicator, perhaps, became the worker deaths. So around 1,000 workers, sometimes close to 1,400, 1,500 workers died in work accidents in Turkey every year under the AK Party. So that brings to something like 15 to 20,000 worker deaths under the AK Party due to work accidents. So this is extremely exploitative capitalism with some social programs, not a lot of social programs, some social programs.
And I also wonder if generally sort of holding up Turkey as this model neoliberal country hasn't always had limits, because in a way, often it's argued that the cronyism and patronage systems that were there in the old Turkey have continued under the AKP and Erdogan. And in a way, this represents the failure of the free market to operate properly in Turkey. So the old state-dependent, patronage-based economic model remains in place, but with just different masters in charge.
Yes, that's also right. And because of this reason, some people in Latin America have, for example, used the concept neoliberal populism. And we could apply that to Turkey, too. And we see populism then in two senses. First, these social policies, which are more globally condoned, but also a persistent patronage system. And the strong patronage system also gives insight into why there isn't a strong reaction within the AK Party itself, or among the AK Party supporters, even voters of the base, against the corruption charges. So the corruption charges really infuriate leftists, liberals, old regime secularists, but they don't infuriate AK Party's own base. And some people are really puzzled about this, but there is nothing puzzling, because depending on how you define corruption, half of the population is a part of this already. So the very big master at the top might be procuring for himself a huge palace, but a lot of people are getting smaller and bigger breadcrumbs out of this system of, you know, quote-unquote corruption. I don't want to even call it that, because it's so systematic and so much a part of the system that the term corruption itself is misleading.
That was Cihan Tuğal talking about the fall of the Turkish model, how the Arab uprisings brought down Islamic liberalism. You can find a link to my review of the book via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. You can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. And if you like the podcast, do rate it on iTunes or Stitcher. Or you can like my Turkey Book Talk Facebook page. Also, do consider supporting the podcast via my Patreon account, where you can make a donation of however much you want to help the cost of producing each episode. Find links to all that on all the Turkey Book Talk pages or on my website. But until next time, thank you very much for listening.